that if you took a course in Hamiltonian's mechanics, would hope you would see the same thing. And actually, you should see it in some math classes too. But basically, what it says is that if we're looking at the dynamics of a system, there are some reference frames that are better to look at. And if we move to an interesting reference frame, we might be able to simplify the dynamics in a way to make an approximation of the dynamics so that we capture most of the interesting physics. And so there's two pieces of the rotating wave approximation. One that says, find an interesting reference frame. And the second that says, if there's some piece of the dynamics which is small and fast, the Hamiltonian is changing rapidly, then we can probably drop that. Okay? So we'll just go through it. But you know, the first thing, it's sort of nice to go and look. And so the classic problem is to have a Hamiltonian, and we'll just write it down for a spin 1/2 particle, because that will be sufficient. That says that I have some frequency about the z direction, and I have some time-dependent piece, and I'll try to keep my factors of two. So we have this time dependence in the Hamiltonian. And look, it's no problem. We can integrate that. And so in this particular plot, all I do is integrate that dynamics. And I start with a state along the plus z-axis. And if you look at that little line there that's moving back and forth, that's the Hamiltonian wiggling back and forth, right? So the Hamiltonian itself has a time dependence. It's going to move back and forth in the xz plane. And so that little line that's moving back and forth along z is the Hamiltonian direction. And you can see what happens is if I start out with the spins, with the vector along z, well, you know, there's an angle between that and the Hamiltonian. And, you know, quantum mechanics is as simple as you can imagine. All that happens is ever a rotation, right? And so if I have a state and a vector of the Hamiltonian, the only thing that can happen is that they rotate about each other, or the state rotates about the Hamiltonian. So it starts to do that. And then in this case, I've set omega t and omega naught to be equal to each other. And if I do that, then we get this really nice dependence that they're always going to be in phase. So that as I continue, even though this vector is just rotating a little bit along the z-axis, and remember I started with the state along the z-axis, that this little wobble leads to a big motion of the state vector. And in fact, it takes the state vector everywhere on the Bloch sphere. Okay? So just this piece, and of course, this drive term is much, much smaller than this. So, you know, if you just looked at this Hamiltonian, you would say, oh, no, this is small. You know, it's a 1/1000th of this term in the simulation. This is some high frequency. You know, I have some small high frequency motion. We should throw it away. But of course, I would miss all of this nice dynamics if I did that. So we want to look at that a little bit more. Now, here, it's pretty easy, I think, to see where you want to move into the reference frame. But let me see if you think so. You know, when I know the answer, it's very easy for me. I say, oh, yeah, it's absolutely obvious. I've known this for 20 years. What reference frame do you like for this problem? Well, so if you're going to describe the action of this vector, the motion of it, yeah.
I mean, it goes around the Hamiltonian, so you want to fix that.
Yeah, that's right. So you say that you know, there's two rotations. There's one, there's this fast rotation about the Hamiltonian, and then there's this slow rotation perpendicular to that. Now, I just want to show you that if you take and you change this parameter slightly, things change a lot. And it's the same simulation. And by changing that parameter slightly, we only ever access a small piece of the Bloch sphere. And of course, by changing this frequency slightly, you know, this Hamiltonian dynamics and the precession due to this term get out of phase with each other. And that's why you don't sample everywhere. Now I want to show you one more thing, and then we can turn this off and talk about some math. If I go back to this expression, to this simulation, and you know, here I've done this numerically, so these pieces are just the step size. Don't get lost with that stuff. But here I plotted the same thing with higher resolution, and now I've plotted the z component of the magnetization versus some time parameter. And these little wobbles, those are not an artifact of my integration. I can integrate better than that. What they are is eventually they're going to show up as being the term that we're going to drop. The difference between these small oscillations and a smooth cosine is something called a Bloch-Seegert shift, which is the first correction to this piece. Okay, so we're going to look at how we do this stuff now. Okay, so that's all I need from this board now. So if we can get rid of this, and let's come back over here. Now, let me describe this Hamiltonian in terms of how we would use it physically. This piece here typically would be a Zeeman interaction. And omega naught would then be the gyromagnetic ratio times some applied magnetic field. The gyromagnetic ratio is a constant for a spin. And often, this is set to be a constant, just because we're using a superconducting magnet and it's not so fun to change. And so here, we typically think that this piece we could equate with what is called a drift or internal Hamiltonian, and that we have no control over that. That's given by our experimental setup. This piece, we would say, we would normally think of as a control Hamiltonian. And so we have some ability to control this. And let me draw an experiment, a simple experiment, and then we'll get to the math. So this is a normal symbol for an electromagnet. Think about the two poles of an electromagnet. When you get over to my lab, we'll show you lots of them. So it'll make sense. And so you have some field, B sub zero, sitting in those. And therefore, in this particular experiment, the z-axis is in that direction. And I'll put the x-axis here. And so it says, oh, okay, I want another field. I'm going to put the coil in here. That's going to create another field. We'll call it B1. And omega 1 has exactly the same ratio to B1 as omega 0 does to the static field, right? So here we see, yes, we have, again, a Zeeman interaction. We just have a coil. We put a current through it. It creates a field. But, of course, I want the current to be oscillating. And so what we end up doing is having a synthesizer. That we can set. We can set it to whatever frequency we want. It comes with a bunch of knobs on the front. And coming out of this, We have some cosine piece. And so by turning the knobs, we can control this. So this is in our control. We control that. And we send it to an amplifier. Because if I want to put a current into a coil, then if I put a current into the coil, then I need power, right? It's a resistive element. I can't take a synthesizer which generates a voltage and drive current into a coil. The impedances don't match. So we need an amplifier that will deliver power into that. And the gain of this will set omega 1. So omega 1 is in our control. We can control that as well. Okay. And you can see that this is a correct description of the physics, that we really do have if I apply a sinusoidal oscillating field to that coil, I apply a sinusoidally oscillating current to that coil, I will get the sinusoidally oscillating field. Good. All right. So now then, let's have a look at how we're going to apply this. The first piece I want to do, actually I could still do it here, is I want to look at this piece, omega 1 cosine omega t sigma x. I'm going to rewrite that in terms of a rotating and counter-rotating field. So if any of you took an analog electronics class, physicists should do that, yeah. Or a signal processing course, not as many physicists do that, but it's a good course to take too, then you'll note that if you have two frequency modulations, you get to out an amplitude modulation. So that's, and you also know this, because you know Euler's equation, but let's write it out. I can rewrite this as omega 1 I don't even need the bracket there. Okay, so if I could get rid of this board, there's a promise that it was going to happen. Thank you. So what does this tell us? It says that if I have a field, an operator, that's rotating, right? This piece says rotate that operator. You'll remember that we can rewrite this as cosine omega t identity plus I sine omega t sigma z, right? And you'll when you multiply it out, you'll say, oh yes, sigma z times sigma x is going to give me I sigma y, right? And so this I will cancel and we'll get the nice expression. Things you've all done before. Yes? Yeah, good. Okay. So this piece says we take sigma x and we rotate it. This piece says we take sigma x and we rotate it the other way. Right? The only thing I've changed here is this sign, which ends up doing nothing to the cosine term, of course, but changing the sign here. So it changes the sense of rotation of this. And now, if I take two vectors, and of course, you know, the Hilbert space is a linear vector space, so I can talk about operators as vectors. So I take two vectors, and I rotate them like this. Then when they're 180 degrees apart from each other, they vanish. So if I took a vector and I rotated it, it looks like a phase modulation. I'm changing the phase of the vector. If I take two vectors and I phase modulate them in opposite direction, then I get an amplitude modulation. Yeah? And this, of course, is an amplitude modulation, and that's a phase modulation. And I've got to throw in a factor of two here, of course, because now I have two vectors to add up. Okay. That's not the rotating wave approximation yet, but it takes and gives us a rotating field. Yeah? Good. Now then, we can rewrite the Hamiltonian. We can say our Hamiltonian is equal to omega naught over 2 sigma z plus omega 1 over 4, right? I have to pick up another factor of 2 from all of this. E to the I omega t sigma z sigma x e to the minus I omega t sigma z plus e to the minus I. Okay. So now we have our Hamiltonian. Now I need the hardest piece. I need to choose what interaction frame I want to go into. And I tell you, it is almost universal that people say, oh, we go into this one. But I'm going to go into this one. Okay, I want to go into this one because when I introduce the interaction frame, I want this term to drop out. I want this thing to be time independent. And the other way I could think about this, if you let me talk as an experimentalist for a second, is to say, hey, I can choose that frequency. So as an experimentalist, so from theory it makes sense, but as an experimentalist it makes even more sense to me because I want to go into the interaction frame that I can control. Experimentalists are only control freaks. Okay. So now then, there is a sign here that I need to get right. And when I get it wrong, it's not a disaster. You can just change it all later on. But what we're going to do is we're going to define a propagator that takes us into the so-called rotating frame. So I'll put it way over here because I'll need that board. So we have something that we were going to call the lab frame. And then we're going to go into something that will be the rotating frame. We'll see what happens as we move from one to the other. And this will index it right now as the lab frame. Okay. And so the rotation that takes us between them is going to be that particular operator. And if I define this operator, then I can associate with it a Hamiltonian, and of course, there. And we're going to get into trouble. There's factors of two everywhere, right? I'm sure I told you I wasn't responsible for factors of two. But there are factors of two everywhere, right? Okay. I'm so worried about the negative sign. The factors of two. Okay, so now then we've got this piece that's going to take us from the lab frame into the rotating frame. And it's a rotation about the z-axis. It's a rotation about the z-axis. Just like one of those fields. And you'll remember then if we look at the time evolution of the density matrix, then we can look at that. It's effectively the Schrodinger equation, often called the von Neumann equation. Doesn't make any difference. And, of course, we know the solution to this, that rho of t is equal to u of t, rho of 0, u inverse of t, and u of t is equal to e to the I h t, all things that you know and love. Okay, now what I want to know is I want to know the time evolution of the density matrix in the rotating frame. So I'm going to define the rotating frame via this operator so that rho tilde is equal to u rotation rho u rotation inverse. Right? And so we're going to go from, again, the lab frame into the rotating frame. And that's fine. We know how to do it when we define the operator that takes us there. So now you'll forgive me for doing simple algebra on the board. So the first thing I'm going to do is to say, we went into a rotating frame. You know, it's just a linear transformation. We haven't changed quantum mechanics at all. So I can define some Hamiltonian associated with that. I don't know what that Hamiltonian is yet, right? That's going to be our problem. We need to find that Hamiltonian. But certainly I know it has this form. But more importantly, I know rho has that form. Okay? So we can just take the time derivative of this. And so we say, oh yeah, we get the immediate gratification here that this looks like the time, you know, derivative of u times rho, u rotation inverse plus u rotation d rho dt, u rotation inverse plus u rotation rho just writing it out in boring detail. But we know what the derivative of the operator is, because I know what the bloody Hamiltonian is. Yeah? So that's cool. We say, oh yeah, this thing here is equal to I omega t over 2 sigma z u rotation. This thing is equal to minus I omega t over 2 sigma z rot inverse. Right? So we're getting almost there. And this piece here, well, I know what this is. Right? This is equal to minus I h rho. Forgive me again for saying obvious things, but if I bring this in, then I will get the term that looks like u rotation h rho u rotation inverse, and I'll get the minus term, right? And then we'll stick in here the identity u rotation inverse u. Yeah. And so now then I say, oh yeah, this is all good. I can transform everything into the interaction frame, right? And so this is fine. I can take and replace this with h tilde Rotilda in the interaction frame. And I am going to get into trouble by using tilde twice. Did I really do that in my notes? Put the word effective there. Don't put the tilde. Okay? Because it's not the same as this one. I'm surprised. I thought it. No. I didn't. I only made a mistake on the board. I didn't do that in my notes. Okay. So now then, we combine all of these terms, and we find that we have the expression that the time evolution of the density operator in the rotating frame is equal to minus I h tilde rho tilde minus I minus h rotation rho tilde. So I've just associated that again with h rotation, right? And so we have this nice expression that says, how do you go into an interaction frame? This is always true. And remember that we're looking at the rotating wave approximation, but we haven't made any approximations yet. This is just moving into an interaction frame. And this piece is the way you should think about it. This is always true. Now, what does it say? It says if I want to look at the dynamics of the density matrix in the interaction frame, then that's fine. I should transform these things into the interaction frame. And then I should look at this particular, I should subtract off that particular operator, right? So I can combine these two into one and have h tilde minus that. Yeah? But let's look at this piece. Here's my Hamiltonian in the interaction frame. Here's my Hamiltonian in the lab frame. And I want it in the interaction frame. I go into the interaction frame by applying this unitary. What happens to this Hamiltonian? Well, the first, what happens with this term? Absolutely nothing, right? Everything commutes. We're just rotating z about z. What happens to this piece? Comes time independent. Yeah? So this just goes to sigma x. What happens to this piece? That's exactly right. It picks up an extra time dependence. So we end up sticking in a factor of 2 there, right? Because remember, we had these two vectors, and they're going like this. And then we say, no, we're going to rotate with 1. And so it looks like the other one goes twice as fast. Okay, so that's easy. It says that this piece here looks like omega naught over 2 sigma z plus omega 1 over 4 times sigma x. That's the first term. Plus e to the minus I twice omega t divided by 2 sigma z sigma x e to the I twice omega t over 2 sigma z. Okay, so that is this piece. And then, of course, over here, we still have minus I omega t sigma z over 2. And so if I define h effective, don't need that, as h tilde minus h rotation, so that we end up with this expression here, then we see that when we subtract this, I go through all of this trouble, and no, there's a negative sign here. This is okay. That's H rotation, but there's a negative sign there. I screwed up the sign again. Omega naught minus omega t over 2 sigma z plus omega 1 over 4 sigma x plus the time dependent part. Good. So now let's understand what's going on. This piece here is called the rotating field. And this piece is called the counter-rotating field. And so when we go from the lab frame into the rotating frame, the rotating field becomes time independent. And the term that was quantizing the system vanishes if we went exactly on resonance. On resonance means that omega t is equal to omega naught. If it's not on resonance, there's a small piece that stays there. Okay, so in the lab frame, we've got D0 here. We've got some field B1 here, and the field rotates at omega t. And then we rotate about z at a frequency of omega t. So we just run around the lab at the same frequency that the spins are moving. And we end up having, along the x-axis in the rotating frame, so we call that xy in the lab frame. In the rotating frame, now we have a field that's sitting here, but it's a field that's half as strong. Right, so it was B1 there, it's B1 over 2 here. And along the z-axis, we have a field that is B0 minus omega 1 divided by gamma. So we call this delta B. And this is the effective field direction, right? The vector sum. And these two are time independent. Now, in addition to this, there's some time dependent piece, right? It says, oh, yes, you get this. Somewhere there's another color of chalk. But in addition, you have a field that's the same order of magnitude that's rotating, and it's rotating at minus twice omega t. And this piece is what we're going to drop, of course. So the approximation says, hey, take take this piece and set it equal to 0. And in first order, that doesn't change any of the dynamics. In second order, you see that in fact, this piece leads to a small change in this effective field direction. And someday you might want to look at that under as the Bloch-Seegert shift. How many of you, you've probably all gone through perturbation theory in some detail. Yes? Resounding yes would be good? Yeah? Okay. We could have done it all that way. You know, it's a little bit nicer from my point of view just to say, hey, We'll go and we'll drop the time-dependent term, and then we'll look in perturbation theory at higher-order corrections. When you do that, of course, you know, you have to be careful, because if I look at dropping this term, you know, it doesn't look so much worse than if I had dropped this term originally. Right? The only difference is a factor of 2 in the amplitude. And so you say, well, you know, what does a factor of 2 allow us to drop one term or not drop the other term? But of course, this thing is nearly on resonance, right? So since the field and the spins are moving the same way, it has a consistent effect on the spins, and so that integrates up. And so, you know, don't just look at the numbers to say, oh, it's small, therefore I can drop it. You can't do that. You really have to think about the physics of these systems. Okay. So we have the rotating wave approximation. And now, of course, I come back over here. We forget about this rotating piece. We only have this time independent field right here, be effective. And if we said, well, what's the action of the spins or the qubits around that effective field? Well, it's always going to be a rotation, right? And so the only thing that will happen is if I have a vector, if I have a state that's sitting here, then it will rotate about that effective field. Yeah? And how fast will it rotate? Well, that's pretty easy too, right? We said that this had a frequency of omega 1 over 2. This has a frequency that we'll call delta omega. And so the frequency that this is rotating at is just the vector sum of those. So all easy to work through the dynamics. Okay, and when you look through the notebooks again, when you look at those small oscillations, that's, of course, from dropping this time-dependent term, that's exactly what you expect, right? That if I see small wiggles, it must be from something that has a fast time dependence. Okay, good. Now what I want to do is to go back to the NV system. Because what we're going to see in the NV system is that the Hamiltonian gets a little bit complicated. And so we're going to use these same ideas to look at the dynamics of the NV system. What's going to happen is that there are a number of terms, the Zeeman term, the zero field splitting, the hyperfine term in the Hamiltonian, and they compete with about the same order of magnitude, but they're in different directions. And so if you look at the Hamiltonian trivially, you think that it has a very simple dynamic. But when you look at the interplay of those Hamiltonians, the dynamic is much richer. And if you end up throwing away the small terms to begin with, that then you actually miss what turn out to be the most interesting and largest terms for the effective qubit. And so we'll need this sort of analysis to go through and do that. And I was going to start, but with 15 minutes left, maybe what I'm going to do is to show you one other piece of the physics, and I'll save all the Hamiltonians for Monday so that you see them all in one step instead of seeing bits and pieces. So, you would like to build a quantum computer, perhaps. And you come over, you look in the lab, and you see this beautiful diamond system. And remember, with the diamond system, because we can apply light to it to set it and to read it out, you know, it's a very nice qubit. We can polarize it, we can rotate it, we can detect it. But the drag is that we have a diamond sample. And I have one NV here. And if we think about the qubits, well, remember how this goes. We've got the electron spin. Which is this weird spin one electron. There's this intersystem crossing, which I'll just do schematically this way, so we can prepare and measure. And so I have a qutrit. And then, you know, there'll be a nitrogen, so I'll get another qutrit. And there'll be a C13 or two. I'll get a couple, one or two qubits. And so I have a really small processor here. My small processor, yeah. Effectively 4 qubits. Yeah? Yes, you can do gates on all of those things. And I'll show you that. And then some random other place on this, you'll have another NV. But these will be separated by some distance, and they're separated accidentally. And remember that our ability to reset and control this one is done confocally, so that we have a big light field. I mean, it's a micron, it's huge. And so I can't have this cube, this NV, closer than a micron, because otherwise I couldn't control them separately. So the second one needs to be at least a micron, and in fact, hundreds of microns or millimeters away, or maybe even in a different diamond sample. And so we need a way of connecting them, and we're not going to connect them through spins, because although the electron spin has this huge magnetic moment, you know, Bohr magneton, it's really small if you look at it from a micron away, right? So we need some other scheme. And so one nice scheme is to say, let's come in with some light. So this is what we're going to use to excite. And let's send this through 2 paths to 2 diamond samples. So we'll stick a diamond here. We're going to focus the light on an NV center in 2 different diamond samples. And then these things are meant to remind you of a Fabry-Perot mirror to say that I have a cavity for the system. And so if I have a cavity, I can direct the light out. That's what we want it for. So we direct the light out, and it will go to this 50-50 beam splitter. And let's call these 2 paths A1 and A2. And then I'll put detectors here. Now this is just like the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And by putting a small delay in one of these things, I can arrange a phase shift. And remember what happened with the Mach-Zehnder neutron interferometer, that we could arrange that we would have constructive interference coming to one and destructive going to the other. So I can say, oh yes, I'll take all of the events that are constructive and they will go to this detector. I just set the phase such that that's the case. And I'll take all the events that are destructive and they'll go to this one. And if any of you have taken a course in quantum optics, you've heard of the Hong-O-Mandel effect. Anyone? No, okay. This is the Hong-O-Mandel effect. And that's all you need to know about that. So we set the phase and we have these two pieces. Now, there's a slight difference in energies between this interaction and this interaction in the light field. So we say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to first put all the spins in the zero state. I can do that. But now I have to remember that I've had two of these. And so the inner system crossing. So we start off by saying everything's in zero. That's easy. We just turn the lights on for a long time, everything is in zero. And now let me get my physics right before I say the wrong thing. Good. And now then, what I'm going to do is to give a microwave pulse that's going to prepare them this in 1 over the square root of 2. So I'm going to prepare them in a coherent superposition of being in the MS equals 0 and MS equals 1 ground state. Now this separation is 3 gigahertz. So all that means that I have to do is apply a short microwave pulse to the spins to do that. So now then I have these two states. But we go ahead and we multiply those out. So what I end up with is the state like so. And then I use the fact that the zero state cycling and the one state cycling are slightly different. And so that this energy here and that energy there are very slightly different. So I'm only going to excite here. But of course, the light comes in, goes through this 50-50 beam splitter, and goes to both of those. I'm exciting this state too. Okay? Good. Now, if the state is in the zero state, then I can get a photon out. If the state is in the one state, I can't get a photon out. But it's in the coherent superposition of zero and one. Okay? So now let's look and see what happens. Well, if I have we need to be careful of my language. I need to be careful of my language. We're looking at this state, but I'm going to, you know, quantum mechanics is linear. I'm going to say, hey, if I had this state corresponding to that part of this two-spin state, if I had this, I see no photons. Right? So in fact, I could know if I had that state. I just shine the light for a long time, and I would say, oh, no, I never saw any photon. It must be that, right? If I have this state, then I'll get the photon from each, and they'll end up over here. So this photons reach the A1 plus A2 detector. If I detect a photon over here, then I don't know which of these I have. And so now then, we've created an entangled state. Now it's an entangled state created conditionally on seeing a photon at the right detector. right? So you, what do you do? You come in, you put everything in the ground state. After you put everything in the ground state, you create these superposition states in both of these, and then you probe it with the light, and you don't see something, in which case you throw it away, or you see something over here, in which case you start over again, or you see something here at this detector, and then you say, ah, keep that one, that's good. And then you have an entangled state that you can start looking at the physics for. And Michel Luc and others at Harvard have recently shown things that are a little bit more complicated, but in spirit, just that. Now, of course, you can see a problem here. There's always problems in these experiments. The probability that the photon actually is emitted into this light pipe, right? I mean, the chance of getting a photon out is bloody abysmal. And so, you know, the most likely thing you do is you see no photons, no photons, no photons forever. And then you get this piece here. And in truth, in the experiment, what it says is after you look at all the mess that comes with it is, oh yeah, there's a probability that you have this state there. You know, if this was atomic physics and I could make all the photons come out, life would be great. But solid state physics is not atomic physics. And so then you say, oh yes, now I have a state that has some entanglement, and now I can go back and do entanglement distillation to try to amplify that and do the rest of it. Okay, but here's an example of taking two different diamonds and entangling them and trying to use them to have an extended quantum processor. Good, so we'll stop here. No lecture tomorrow. We'll have two lectures on Monday. So I understand that the evening meeting doesn't work today, so next week we'll do that. Next week we'll go into the physics, a little bit of the NV to show you what the Hamiltonian really looks like and what you can do. And then I want you to quickly move to the superconducting system, because the superconducting system today gives you one thing that none of this does, is that you can build by hand any Hamiltonian you like. And, you know, that's a sort of a nice toy to say by hand, you can design a Hamiltonian, you can build, you can go to your E-beam writer, you can fabricate it, and you can go into a lab and have whatever Hamiltonian you would like for your experiment. And so we'll try to describe to you a little bit how you can do that. Thanks.